VentureCast.
And they were great. I mean, you know, we used to go to Boston to see bands from Providence too. And so I know that we're talking more about Providence, but I would go to the Paradise.
Sure.
I saw X there on their first tour, opening with Mission of Burma, local band opening for them.
Yeah.
Mission of Burma ended with Break On Through to the Other Side.
That's great. I am so loving. Ever. I love the specificity of your memory of shows. Like you and I share this. Like people are always laughing. Like, do you remember in the fifth song where the lights went out and you turned to the guy and they're like, no, we don't remember that. But you were obviously like with me. Like I can still like remember I wasn't set lists from show like 35 years ago.
50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
So sorry, that's my dog Leon.
Leon, I actually hadn't penciled him in. This is great. I'll get him in the show notes. Jeff Simons is here, and we're welcoming in our New England artist in residence, Mark Netter, CEO of Electrocast Podcast Network. But also, your career is just kind of all over the place, is it not?
Unfortunately, yes.
Professor. Screenwriter, director. Were you an agent once, or did you work at an agency?
No, I've spent 17 years in entertainment advertising, and I worked for entertainment ad agencies. And over the course of that, I did work for every major movie studio, every major broadcast network, a lot of cable networks, some tech companies like Adobe and Intel, a lot of video game companies. So that was my entertainment experience. And I tailed out at Warner Brothers, moving in-house for just a temporary assignment to help launch DC Universe, the ill-fated OTT service that AT&T promptly killed when they took over.
Oh, gosh.
And we're about to add Raconteur to that list because you're gonna entertain us with stories of New England rock and roll scene.
Before all that, before that career began, you were a lowly university student hitting Lupo's Heartbreak Hotel in Providence, Rhode Island. Were you not?
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, I went to school in Providence, Rhode Island, and it was a long time ago. So I think I'm about 10 years too old for your podcast.
No, I can't imagine.
So I'll tell you, concert tickets were so cheap back then that, you know, I would see, it wouldn't be unusual to see four acts a month. And they would both be on campus. It would be downtown Providence, Rhode Island. There were probably three venues where we would see stuff in Rhode Island. The big one, which was, you know, not the greatest for me, you know, the acoustics, was the Providence Civic Center.
Right.
And I have a couple of good stories about that. And then Lupo's Heartbreak Hotel was the incredible bar, the one that had a balcony inside of the bar. It was still very intimate. And the acts I saw there are just like legends. And there was also a place called The Living Room that I went to less often, but was also considered to be a good place to listen to new music.
And so just for the fans listening at home, Mark actually went and found a photograph of Lupo's Heartbreak Hotel. He has it as his background on the Zoom call. So you and I both have fake backgrounds on the Zoom call. just rattle off top of your head, five biggest acts you saw when you were a college student.
Okay.
Not favorites, just biggest.
Okay, biggest. So through a friend, which I'm from upstate New York. I was from like a small town outside of Albany called Delmar, New York.
Okay.
But I got matched with a guy from Los Angeles. And the first day that they're there, he introduced me to somebody that he had met at the send-off party in LA who's from Beverly Hills. Guy named Dan Nickel, who's one of his best friends' father was Joe Smith, the record executive who signed the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, Warner Brothers.
Basically was responsible for Bonnie Raitt having a career twice and the second time really hitting it big. Just a huge record exec, and also the Eagles. Yep. So the Eagles are touring behind the Long Run album. Jeff gets us all seats through Dan, through Jeff. We get seats. Jeff didn't go to my school, but his sister was a year after us at the same school. And so we get seats, and they're great seats at the Providence Civic Center. So it's a big, huge place, but we're pretty centered and not terribly far up.
Okay.
And as the show is getting ready to begin, we see that they've set up some seats on stage to the side, on stage with where the Eagles are going to play.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, Jeff, his sister Julie, and his father and mother come out and are sitting on stage. And
not bad.
I was not a huge Eagles fan at the time. I've since become, you know, kind of like I'm hooked on several of their songs. I learned how to play, I don't know if I can still do it, but I learned how to play Hotel California, at least one of the chord versions on guitar.
Okay.
But it was a great show, and that was maybe the hugest. I also saw the Grateful Dead at the Providence Civic Center.
Okay.
I will tell you that I was bored at the Grateful Dead show. And
hit and miss, man. So hit and miss, those Dead shows.
I was not a Deadhead. And they were like, oh, the next show was better. And they were like, oh, did you hear the drum solo on the next show and the drum jam, whatever they called it. And then later I saw them in Glens Falls, New York, and I had a great time.
Okay.
So the Dead redeemed themselves in my eyes then. But at Lupo's, I saw a number of acts that are huge. And at the time, they either were coming up, so they weren't huge yet.
Okay.
Or had been huge and they were kind of not huge anymore, but they would be huge again. And the three that I'll mention to you are this. Number one would be the Pretenders US tour. So, and they still had, you know, Pete Farndon and James Honeyman Scott were still alive, right? It was early in the tour, and opening for them and joining them for the encore, which was Stop Your Sobbing, was Chris Spedding, the legendary guitarist from England.
Yeah.
Who was basically in ducktail, you know, hairdo and leather jacket, and looked like he was about to like hop on the motorcycle to leave the show, probably was. So he opens, and I loved Chris Spedding, you know, all the stuff was basically instrumental that he did. And then the Pretenders came out, and we had been listening to the songs, and so we knew them a bit. But I can tell you, like, the songs that really hit hard, like Precious, was unbelievable.
Yeah. You know?
With the famous fuck off in the middle of it. Before they did Tattooed Love Boy, she said, this song is for any girl who's ever been beaten up by her boyfriend. That was that was nice for Chris. Chrissy was tough. She was like wearing leather.
Edgy.
Too.
That's leather. Edgy song intro for 1980, man.
Really edgy. And then, of course, like one of my huge favorites for them is The Weight, which I think is just like an outstanding. And live, we were like losing our minds. I mean, we're all on our feet the whole time. We're losing our minds. Another one on their first U.S. tour. And my buddy, who I was just mentioning earlier, Greg Stern, who was the guy I was matched with as a roommate originally from L.A., had become a kind of a big DJ at the school radio station. And so he got to introduce the Go-Go's.
Nice.
And the Go-Go's come on stage, and they were like literally like the album had, I think, just hit number one or was on its way to hit number one. And, you know, it's crazy. And of course, as a young guy, you spend, you know, half the time trying to figure out which Go-Go you want to date. You know, in half the show over here with Kathy Valentine.
Right.
Yeah, it's just Gina Shock. But anyways.
Yeah, I know. Gina's really, she was, you know, everybody loves Gina. But they were amazing. I mean, they were, you know, they got the beat and the whole thing. We were losing our minds. And
that's a great example of the rock promotional system wasn't caught up yet with the charts. Like, there's no way you'd have the number one album and be playing. Like, I have a recording from that first tour where they're playing Cherry Hill Community College in New Jersey. And their record's in the top five. And they're playing like a 900-seat basketball arena at a community college. Like, nowadays, as soon as they figured out you were selling records, they'd have you in better places. But things I love about that moment in rock history is your tour wouldn't get rerouted for the first 6 months. And then, you know, the next time they come to town, they've jumped four arenas, you know?
Well, I mean, it happened to me with Springsteen. I saw him in Albany the second night of the Darkness on the Edge of Town tour.
Ah,
and he hadn't toured for 3 years. And the guy comes out. He'd just done Buffalo the night before. We heard Prove It All Night on the radio the day before. Haven't heard the album yet.
Uh-huh.
And he comes out and they open up with Badlands. And it's at the Palace Theater in Albany, which is like 2,000 seats. And I'm in the sixth row. And I actually ran down on the third song. Oh. On the third song, I ran down. Second song was Night. I can't believe I remember this. Third song was Spirits in the Night. And he comes out and he's walking outside of the stage and he slapped my hand. And then I ran back to my seat. But within 2 months, you could only see him in an arena.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, okay. So Pretenders, so Go-Go's, who's your third Lupo's band?
Okay. James Brown.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. At Lupo's.
With the Fabulous Flames, and it was so he was kind of in a downturn of the career a little bit,
sure.
And he came back up again with Living in America and stuff, and he blew up all over again. But he comes out, you know, and we're all like James Brown, and we had loved like Night Train and the stuff from the Apollo album and all that. And it was such a classic. It was like the classic rock and roll show where he doesn't come out at first; his MC comes out,
right,
with the band, and they're basically revving it up, and it's phenomenal. Like we're having the greatest time. And then he comes out and he's mind blowing. And I guess he was probably, I can't imagine he was probably was at least 45, maybe 50 at the time. But when he did that first split all the way to the floor and pop back up again, like a Jack in the Box, we're losing our mind.
Oh yeah.
That'll do it.
And he did like a 10-minute version of Sex Machine. And at one point goes and takes over the piano and is playing piano.
Yep. There's some of those great, I don't know if you know this, Tim, but James Brown put out a bunch of instrumental records. Like he put out a record like every 3 months. I mean, he was just like material. And a lot of them would just be like warm up jams that they were recording to get levels right. And he'd be like, that's good enough, put it out. But there's all these really hilarious James Brown records where he's doing organ solos and he's just so funky. And such a natural musician that they're actually pretty listenable. But he's obviously a guy who's like figuring out how to play the organ while he records an organ solo. And he's like, boop, 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 boop. I mean, it's almost more percussion than actual notes, but it's actually great at the same time.
I mean, he had the big hair, you know, he was just, it was, and it is, you're right. He's like, he was the funkiest man alive.
That's so awesome.
I love and the I'm idea. Not
even, I feel like I'm missing out some of the acts that I saw that were also amazing. I saw the Talking Heads twice.
Okay.
Oh, so
first time I saw them was at college, and it was in this place called Alumni Hall, which is standing room only. And it was more songs about buildings and food. Their second album is out, and they're from Providence. They went to RISD right down there.
Yeah, they met. Yeah, I was going to say they almost all of them, right?
Except for Jerry Harrison, who was from Boston, and he was in the Modern Lovers, the original Modern Lovers, and you know, an integral part of that.
And he's now a neighbor of mine in Mill Valley. Jerry Harrison's
I actually met him up there. After a Jonathan Richman show at Sweetwater's.
Okay. So Sweetwater's that's one of my regular stages. I play there all the time. And there's a great little kind of homegrown scene coalescing around that spot.
It's so great. The last guy I saw there was Walter Trout. Do you know Walter Trout?
Sure.
Unbelievable guitarist. Sounds like Hendrix.
Fantastic.
Guy now. But yeah, really great. So yeah, the Heads were amazing. So it started off with Chris France was sitting in the audience having a cocktail, like sitting cross-legged on the floor, and people were gathering around, old friends and stuff. And then they do the show, and it was unbelievable. And we kept saying, my friend Dan goes, look at his head. It's so big. And David burned it big. So that was like crazy, right? And then afterwards, we're like, let's try to get backstage. So we start going backstage, and they're like, oh, okay, are you here to see David? And we're like, yes. And so a couple of us are like, we're getting backstage. We get all the way to David Byrne, sticking his head out of the dressing room, and the green room, and he goes, no, sorry, guys. It's not the guys I'm looking for. Sorry.
Oh, no.
I got another good one for you.
Big head out the door.
He's got his big head. And then I saw him on the Fear of Music tour, but that was downtown at, I forget the name of the theater. It wasn't the Orpheum, but it was a interesting theater downtown. And it was a good show because the music was good, but they were not getting along, and you could tell.
Oh yeah,
that's always rough.
And then is that the tour before they added like Adrian Belew and Dillette McDonald and everybody? It was like
but I don't think he was on the tour. And then the best show I've ever seen in my entire life was the Stop Making Sense tour. in Forest Hills in New York, but that was not Providence. So it doesn't, not Jermaine.
It doesn't count.
How about this? How about this? The original Ramones lineup.
Oh, awesome.
Wow.
Am I hurting you guys yet?
Is that, was that also at Lupo's?
That was at Alumni Hall as well.
Okay.
And I saw him a second time too. But the thing about the Ramones was, you have to remember, back then they were considered freaks. The idea that they were just 2.5 minute songs and that they all sounded alike, and everyone would joke about it, and you would go there and you'd have the best time because, you know, Joey would just, between songs, would just go, what? And then the next song would start. We were losing, you know, we're having a great time. Sheena is a punk rocker, you know.
Right. I mean, it's like 27 songs in an hour. It was just, you know, just a cloud of dust.
Unbelievable. You know, and the greatest thing about the Ramones is that, you know, by the time they all started dying, they couldn't get arrested, you know, or get a concert or anything, and except in Brazil. And now little kids wear their t-shirts. Like,
I know. It is the single most popular rock and roll t-shirt in America. Like,
don't they sell it at Target now? I mean, it's insane.
They sell, I mean, don't be knocking Target. That's
okay.
Target, no, Target's
taste makers, those guys.
I got one more story about this, about the Ramones though. So I'm there again, and my friend Dan, I'm with him again, right? And at one point he decides to untie Dee Dee Ramone's shoe.
We're
close to the stage. So he pulls the string that tied Dee Dee Ramone's, the shoelace on Dee Dee Ramone's shoe. And all Dee Dee does, he's playing that, you know, bass, bah, 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 bah. He looks down, he puts the shoe up on an amp, a roadie runs out, ties the shoe,
and
goes back to play. Yes, you're the best!
Awesome.
That is great. Well, Mark, we have to do on our New England podcast is we have to figure out who is our favorite artist, or who's the best artist in these six states of ours here. So you've talked a lot about some of the big names. Any bands that were kind of small that you saw, or that you had personal favorites?
Absolutely.
You were there from 81 to 85?
Thank you. 78 to 82.
I knew it was in that ballpark. Yes.
Yeah.
78 to 94, somewhere in there.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. 2018. No.
Well, that's a great time to be there, though.
It was a great time. I tell you, the shows were cheap. There were so many good stuff. So there were a few things. So occasionally bands would come down from Boston, like Human Sexual Response. I don't know if you guys knew those.
Sure.
They had, my favorite of theirs was, well, they did Cool Jerk, which is a great version of that, which also the Go-Go's did Cool Jerk, the classic cover.
Yep. By the Capitals, I believe, the original band that did Cool Jerk.
That's correct. Absolutely correct. And the their two big ones were What Does Sex Mean to Me? What Does Sex Mean to History? You know, they do this whole What Does Sex Mean to Me? Sex. They had four lead singers, which was kind of crazy. And then their big one was I Want to Be Like Jackie Onassis. Do you know that one?
I do, yeah. I bought that record. It was one of those records I bought that my parents just looked at and then looked at me and like they were just too afraid to ask. So
I want to be like Jackie Onassis. I want to wear a pair of dark sunglasses.
Yep.
But I'll tell you, the local band that really we were fans of at the time, and this is deep Providence stuff, and they never quite made it, which sucked, was the Mundanes. Have you ever heard of the Mundanes?
No.
Great name.
Let me describe the Mundanes. So they were definitely a new wave band, skinny ties and all that. There were three guys named Jonathan in the band. There was a lead singer named Marcia, and the main guitarist Jonathan would sometimes be the lead singer. There was a bassist who was a total oddball named named Dean, and Dean kind of went off the rails a little bit. He started wearing different, like they would basically come with like white shirts, black ties. Marcia would wear a black dress with like maybe like a black pantsuit with like a white shirt or something.
Okay.
So they all kind of looked alike, right? They would have the skinny ties. Jonathan Gregg was the lead guitarist. And then there was a keyboardist named Jonathan Linnell, which I need to get back to in a minute.
Oh,
so you'll know who he is. And then Dean went like off the rails and kind of, I think, got a little too into partying, and one would show up like wearing like an orange jumpsuit while everybody else looked different. But we love the Mundanes, and they would do, their big covers were Down in the Boondocks. Do you know that song?
Mm-hmm.
Billy Joe Royal, Down in the Boondocks.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which we loved. They had a song called Small Town Suburban Girl that was great. Or Small Town Suburban Boy. They were just a bunch of really great songs. So they wrote good songs. They did good covers, but they ultimately didn't quite break through. I don't know what happened. Right. They, you know, what it was like in those days, but we would always go to see the Mundanes, and they really kind of typified new wave. Like, they weren't punks. They weren't punky punks. Dean was trying to be a punk. I think that's what he was kind of going for. Ended up seeming more like the Tubes, you know, the way he dressed and stuff.
Okay.
But, who I also saw in Providence. But Jonathan Linnell was really interesting. So he was this skinny kid, the youngest. He was the keyboardist. He kind of did the Farfisa type thing on the keyboards. He moves to New York and actually did some work. I think music, or maybe it was office work or something, did some work. I think some music work for my wife's, for a company my wife worked for that did corporate events and corporate videos. And he had moved to Brooklyn and become partners in music. I don't know if in life, but definitely in music, with another guy named Jonathan, more Jonathans. And they formed the band They Might Be Giants. The rest of that is history. You got the Daily Show theme and all that. So I'd always excited to see Jonathan Linnell. And because he's such a good guy, and he would talk to us after the gigs and stuff and things like that. He was the friendliest of all of them. But they used to have this thing called Dial-A-Song. And I don't know if you guys ever heard of this, but
sure. That's where I first heard Were the Replacements was on Dial-A-Song.
Oh, okay. So basically back then, you know, we had in the 80s, we had phone machines in New York. You know, we didn't have, you know, phones or like cell phones or anything. So you had phone machines, and they would put a new song on their outgoing message every day, the two Jonathans.
Wow.
You dial the number and you'd hear a new song every day. Might be a snippet, but it was like,
right, sure, but still.
And so, not surprising that they put out all those albums. Yeah.
I saw They Might Be Giants in college, and it was terrific because it was like rock show, but also performance art. And they had, it was kind of like if Penn and Teller were a rock band. I mean, they were hilarious and those songs kicked ass. I mean, like there's one great song after another. That was one of the best shows.
All these things. Yeah. And it was just, you know, it was, so they were a really fun band and they were great. I mean, you know, we used to go to Boston to see bands from Providence too. And so I know that we're talking more about Providence, but I would go to the Paradise.
Sure.
I saw X there on their first tour, opening with Mission of Burma, local band opening for them.
Yeah.
Mission of Burma ended with Break On Through to the Other Side.
That's great. I am so loving ever. I love the specificity of your memory of shows. Like you and I share this. Like people are always laughing. Like, do you remember in the fifth song where the lights went out and you turned to the guy and they're like, no, we don't remember that. But you were obviously like with me, like I can still like remember I wasn't set lists from show like 35 years ago.
The other I will tell you that, you know, again, taking the 1 hour bus from Providence to Boston, the other best show I ever saw, pretty close to that Talking Head show, was the Clash on their first US tour at Harvard Square Theater.
Now you're killing me.
Wow.
You're killing me. I missed the original lineup. I caught the fake Clash that Strummer and Simonon took out in 85 for the Cut the Crap tour, but I was just too young to sneak out and see the original lineup. Like that one hurts.
It'll hurt you. I saw them twice. I saw them on the London Calling tour too. But that was at the Orpheum in Boston.
Yeah, I have a tape of that show. That's the 16 Tons tour. They're the best band on earth.
Does it have the part where they tell the audience to stop, you know, hurting each other?
Yeah, yeah.
They almost stopped the show. Because what happened between the first one, so the first time we go to see the Clash, only the art punks are there. Second time, there's motorcycle punks.
Yeah.
And there's cop presence. And the tough crowd are getting into trouble, like in front of the stage. And they literally say, guys, we'll stop playing if you don't. But the first tour, that first show at Harvard Square, which doesn't exist anymore, the theater was all art punks. And they had this thing where they would always open with a local band. Then they would have a classic rock and roller that they would bring out of retirement or out of maybe just their career downswing and give them a new life. The second time was Lee Dorsey working in a coal mine. But the first one we saw, it was the Unprovoked Retaliation tour. And I got to tell you, I could just lay it out for you. So they opened with this band, The Rentals, who were terrible. And they opened up with, we're The Rentals and you're not. And we're like, you suck. And they sucked. And then Bo Diddley.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought it was Bo Diddley. There's great photos of Bo Diddley hanging out with The Clash looking very bemused. Yeah.
Well, I can't tell you how good Bo Diddley was. And he's grinding with that box guitar. He's doing grind moves. And we're all going like, we love Bo Diddley. Like, we loved it. It was fantastic.
That is great.
Much better than Lee Dorsey, by the way. Lee Dorsey was more of a crooner or singer.
Yeah. Really that Yes We Can record is great, but
yeah, it was a long time ago. Lee Dorsey, but like, yeah. But Bo was a cut above. And then the Clash come out and they have this huge, the backdrop is all flags of the world sewn together. And one that's kind of like just above their head says Unprovoked Retaliation.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the first song they did was I'm So Bored with the USA.
What a show.
There's a show. And I'll tell you one other thing that happened. It was such a great show. It was unbelievable. At one point, Mick Jones got a chance to sing his song Stay Free from the second album. And he goes, I'll never forget this. More specificity.
Yeah.
He says, I had a boss from Boston once. And everybody goes, yeah, yay. He goes, he was a real cunt. You know what I mean?
Make him friends.
Pulled the rug out from under us. And the way they stood on stage, they had this wide leg stance where it really looked like they were like soldiers. And they were dressed like soldiers, kind of. Especially Paul Simonon had like, I think even had khaki on.
Yeah.
And when Mick and Joe or Mick and or Paul and Mick would switch sides, they would like, it was almost like a military move, the way they would move.
Oh, wow.
It was like, we walked out of that concert. And I remember I was with a bunch of other guys from my school. Our hair was steaming in the night. The tops of our head, steam was coming off in the night.
That sounds like New England.
That,
right there.
I remember that from shows at the 9:30 Club in D.C. You go see Fugazi, and you look like a matchstick.
Yeah, So Mark, you're from New York. You only spent 4 years in New England, right? Because after school, you then go to New York. And then you've been in California.
Well, I went to New York City. Yeah. California.
So tell us, is the tough question of the night. Has New England shaped your artistic visions? Has New England shaped, or those 4 years shaped, how you kind of view the world and view art?
Yeah. I mean, in a number of ways. I mean, first of all, college, totally shaped the way I viewed things. And I took a lot of courses. I was at Brown University and I majored in semiotics, which is the study of signs and symbols. And I watched a ton of movies. I read French philosophers like Roland Barthes and Jacques Derrida. Well, I read some Jacques Derrida. I couldn't really make my way through it. Barthes was much more user-friendly.
Those are not New England guys.
Not New England guys. But I also think that there's a certain...
Wasn't a lot of Derrida and Situate, Tim? Is that what you're telling me?
Not a lot. In Seacock, not a lot of Jacques Derrida fans in Seacock. But I think that what it was downtown Providence. Providence at the time was, kind of still being rebuilt.
Yes.
And... the mayor, Buddy Cianci, who became the disgraced mayor and went to jail and then became mayor again.
Yeah.
He actually did a lot to really help the town.
Uh-huh.
It was really interesting. And I think some of the architecture, the fact that it was a really arty town, not only did you have RISD there, but you had RISD graduates living there. I dated someone from RISD at one point, kind of opened up this whole art world to me. You could live super cheap at the time, which I don't even know if you can anymore. So people would be living in, like an old 1940s duplex on the top floor, and it would be, a lot of bare wood and stuff, but a little cold in the winter, but great. And you could have bands. I always think that you kind of need cheap rents for bands to be able to grow in any place for a music scene to happen. Happened in Seattle, happened in Austin, happened in Athens, and then once the money comes in, it becomes really harder for those bands to function. It's not quite the same thing anymore.
Yep.
So I think a lot of that aesthetic was really, it's almost like the David Lynch Philadelphia aesthetic a little bit.
Okay.
He went to art school in Philadelphia. And so you see that in Eraserhead a lot, that kind of, in post-industrial. I think that there was a lot of art and culture going on. I took a couple classes or took one class at RISD, maybe two. I can't remember. It definitely affected how I thought about things. And I think there was always this thing about the Providence Boston bands, the Jonathan Richmond and the Modern Lovers was kind of a real seminal band for us. We used to listen to that first Modern Lovers record over and over and over again. And then also just to be there at the time when punk and new wave exploded, when I was a young teenager, I didn't really feel like, aside from like the Beatles, and then when I discovered the Stones, it was like a huge thing, because people would say to me, what's your favorite kind of music? And, you know, we would go to, like, the first concert I ever went to was Renaissance.
That's a little different.
Yeah, and my third was Zappa, you know, but it was like, I never felt like there was really my music until punk and new wave happened. Wow, and then I was like, I totally get this. And I really felt like I was there. You know, we would put on like old, like someone would have like a prep school jacket and, you know, kind of write on it or something. And I would wear that to a show. Or
right.
I remember one night, a couple of women put makeup on me to go to like see one of the shows or something like that, which at the time was like, the New York Dolls did that. You know?
Yeah. It's so funny how we talk about this on the podcast, that music meeting us at just the right time, like right when we're ready for it, suddenly it arrives on our doorstep and has its effect. Yeah. Well, this has been awesome. Love having you on our podcast. Before we go, just really quick, in like 3 minutes or so, explain to Jeff your new music club that you did in the 1980s in New York, just because
if there is
a younger person listening, this is going to blow your mind about how music was discovered back in the day.
Okay. So I'll be quick about it, because I know my family's kind of waiting for me for dinner over here. So you get to a certain point in your 20s where, I don't know about you guys, maybe not, but for us, it starts to become hard to keep up with new music. You know, you just don't have the same disposable time to keep up with new music. So I had been working at a music for TV company, and it was my first job out of school. And I eventually started working on background music for the Olympics and being a music supervisor for Olympic broadcasts. And so I was cutting stuff on quarter inch tape. And I put together a couple reels and turn them into a cassette tape and send them to some of my friends. So they decide to be inspired by this and started a tape club, which I was not even allowed to be in the first group. For some reason, they didn't invite me, like assholes. But eventually what developed was this. You would receive a package in the mail, and we had people in New York. We had a member in Austin, Texas. We had a member in San Francisco, a member in LA, a member, I don't know where else, one in Rhode Island, and a couple of us in New York. And you would receive a package in the mail, and it would contain 7 cassette tapes. And you would copy all the cassette tapes, or whichever ones you wanted to. You would make a Xerox of the label, you know, that they had put in there with all the songs and stuff. Or what I started doing is I would just drop in Xeroxes so people could already have them, because I'd put pictures on them and stuff. And so you would have this library suddenly of like, what's 7 times an hour and a half, you know, that much music to listen to. Yep. And you would take out your previous tape, put in your new mix that you created. You'd write a letter to everybody and you'd send it to the next person. And the one rule that we had was that it was frowned upon to put more than one song by the same artist on the tape. You know how you get like a new album, you're like, oh my God, I love both these songs. I can't
choose. I love it. You got to pick.
The only time you were allowed to do that is if you're going to do like an entire compilation. So like one guy did a Frank Sinatra one guy did a Rolling Stones 2 cassette tape version.
There we go.
And those were crazy. But like, you know, I'd get one that was like filthy old blues songs was one of them that a guy had, you know, another one with incredible reggae, you know, I would tend to do eclectic kind of stuff with all different, you know, so many different single songs that I love. They weren't necessarily the singles off the albums, but they were the ones that I liked. And it was always such a joy to get it. And what ends up killing it is eventually people just get too slow about moving it on.
Turnover, yeah. Right?
Yeah, but we did this for a number of years. And then eventually
I was in a group like that for years and years, and it's just the greatest. In fact, I have a good friend who sent a cold letter to Cameron Crowe after Almost Famous, and I just love that. And by the way, here's my end of the year CD mix, like my favorite songs of the year. And he and I have been making these for each other for like 10 years. Crow not only wrote him back, but sent him his own version and added him to his list. So every year he gets Cameron Crowe's best songs of the year mix. It's so great.
For a while we tried doing CD club, which was kind of okay, but there's something about
it's not the same, is it? It really isn't.
Because you really are mixing. You really are, even if you're not mixing, you really are sequencing the songs a certain way. You're figuring out where one ends and the other begins and trying to tighten that up or loosen it up or whatever. And then when you get to the point where it's like, well, I'll just send you a playlist on Spotify, it's like, where's the magic?
It's different. I tell you.
I tell you where the magic is on Spotify. It's on the Electrocast podcast.
There you go.
Yes, specifically this show.
And our first Electrocast soundtrack album, Pod to You Drop Volume 1.
Darn right. Woo! Featuring yours truly on bass. Yeah.
Fantastic song.
Awesome. And happy to be there.
Yeah. I just think there's something about the analog age. And I was talking to a guy who was fixing my computer in the Apple store, a young guy. And we started talking about, he says, yes, he has vinyl. And he does turn off his phone at night before he goes to bed and stuff like that. And he started asking me, I'm saying like, yeah, you'd go to a town and you wanted to know where the cool people were. You had to find the cool place. You had to know which coffee shop to go to or which college to be near. Like everything was analog, or you knew one guy at that town or one woman and she would tell you, open up the world to you and you'd be there. And suddenly there's a party that night at their place and there's all these cool people. Whereas if you were just to walk through the town yourself, you'd be like, where's the coolness?
Yeah.
And now it's all on the internet. But back then it was like, it was analog and it kind of grew out of the beatniks all the way through to when analog ended.
Times, they are a-changing. Well, Mark Netter, thank you so much for being our artist in residence for all of New England.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it, guys. I love talking about this stuff. And
it's so fun. So
Jeff,
fun.
Jeff, you're right. The memory of this stuff, these are such wonderful moments that they just don't.
Well, next time we have you on, we'll each do our top five random concert memories that we treasure the most.
So that'll be fun.
That'll be a good
one.
So
fun.
Have a great holiday and safe travels tomorrow, Mark. Thanks for your time.
Great holiday. Great Thanksgiving to both of you guys. Thank you.
Bye, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
Miles, are you ready to record our promo for season 2 of the Wanna Bet podcast?
David, have you ever seen a grown man naked?
Miles, we're not here to quote lines from Airplane. We're here to tell people that season 2 starts August 18th.
But I like Airplane.
I know you do, but Wanna Bet is a sports betting podcast. Each week we bet $1,000 on the NFL teams and games that we love.
Well, that sounds like fun.
It is fun. And last year you picked over 60% of your games correctly.
How'd you do?
We're not talking about that. We are telling people that they can find us every Friday. So no more movie quotes.
Roger, Roger.
Electricast.
Introducing the Deep Leadership Podcast. Leadership is a people business. That's the philosophy of your podcast host, John Rennie. As a former submarine officer who spent 22 years leading businesses in corporate America before starting his own manufacturing business, he knows that leadership matters.
Leadership matters.
Deep Leadership is real-world, actionable leadership advice from John and his expert guests. Become a leader worth following. Subscribe today.
Electricast.